go away for 10 days and suddenly they spring summer on you and you get back. It is nice to be here. It's nice to be back. Our opening words come from the Reverend Erica Hewitt, a minister in Maine. She writes, "This Unitarian Universalist congregation is a balm for broken hearts, a beacon for those in need of hope. We are a laboratory of the human soul, always striving to be wiser, braver, more compassionate. While we come to this place to renew our spirits, we also recognize that our spiritual development doesn't happen without discomfort and being challenged. Today is one of those Sundays when we enter Brave Space in service of our living tradition and its call to be a beloved community." I would invite forward any children or young at heart still in the pews, and we'll have one moment while Susan Lang lights our chalice, symbol of our faith, the light around which we gather. Hi. We're going to do something today. I need actually some volunteers. I need a lot of volunteers actually today. Because I need somebody who can be a human mirror to me. Would you like to be one? Okay. Really, I think I'm going to ask all of you to do it if you can. You can do it too? Fantastic. So I've got lots of volunteers. That's great. So one at a time, I'd like you to act like you are a human mirror. So what does that mean, being a human mirror? It means reflecting back to me what you see. Does that make sense? Exactly. You see yourself in the mirror in the bathroom. So I'm going to ask you to come up and say, you have something on your face. I actually have tulip dirt on my face, but yes. It's good for my immune system to, get dirt in the system. So I'm going to ask you to come up and say, you have something on your face. And then I'm going to answer you. Okay? And then somebody else is going to take a turn and they're going to say the same thing. You have something on your face. Okay. You ready to go first? Okay. Hi. What are you talking about? Ah, you're wrong. I'm not going to listen to you. Thank you. Sophia? Hi. You have something on your face. Sorry? Sophia says you have something on your face. Funny you should say that, because you're the one who has something on your face, Sophia. No. Yes. Oh, you must be joking. I'm an expert face washer. I've been doing it for years. In fact, I've been studying face washing and a professional. Winston? How dare you tell me that I have something on my face? You don't get to play with me anymore. Yes, I do, Sophia. I have something on my face. What's wrong with me? I'm going back to bed. What? You already went. Would you like to go? No. Anybody else want to tell me I have something on my face? No. Hiro. I sure do, but everybody has something on their face, so why mention it? Why would you say that? There's nothing we can do about it. It's always going to be this way. Everybody has something on their face. No, so can you ask me one more? Can you tell me one more time? I have something on my face. Thank you for telling me. I've been washing it away, bit by bit, but I guess some of it's stickier than I thought. I really appreciate your letting me know. Would you be willing to help me wash my face? Thank you. Thank you, Jane. Can you help me wash my face off? How do you feel? Yeah. Much better. I do indeed have some on my hands. I fear Jane may have some on her as well. Are there answers there that feel like better answers to you? When you heard me answering you, were there some that felt better to hear back? Which ones? Which ones were hard to hear? You can play this game as well. Which response? No, you don't. No, I don't. I do. Yeah. No, I don't. Maureen says, I'm not going to play with you anymore, is the answer that would be hard to hear. What did we like better about the last answer? Liz liked it. Thank you for telling me. The realization there's something on my face. Right? Yeah. That would be a good answer, or question, or yes. Thank you very much. This is a really important lesson that we're going to be talking about more today, and that you'll be talking a little bit more about too. Wow. That had a lot of energy. Thank you. I'm going to take it back a little bit. We're going to dial it down a touch. We're going to get a little quieter. In this moment, I invite you to take a deep breath. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Notice as you breathe where you feel that breath go. Does it go into the open, comfortable spaces of your body? Does it move easily into some spaces more than others? Are there places in you where opening up hurts? Where it takes a big stretch to make space? Feel those places, touch them tenderly, note where they lie. And remember that stretching is essential to growth, to change, to getting stronger, being more flexible. Breathe again. Make more space. We'll take a moment as I ring the bell. Breathe and stretch and grow together. After a minute, I'll ring the bell to welcome you back. I invite you to return to stay seated as we sing number 391, Voice Still and Small. I want to open our dialogue with a prayer from my colleague, the Reverend Joe Cherry, that he wrote while he was at the Unitarian Church of Vancouver. If we have any hope of transforming the world and changing ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort. Brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and others. May we in this moment as a people of faith be granted the strength to be so bold, to be so brave, and to be so loving of one another. I'm glad to see so many of you here today on a Sunday when we've committed to talking about something that most of us are pretty darned uncomfortable talking about. I suspect. I know that I most certainly am. If I had the choice, I might not have been here today either. We're doing something a little unusual today, and I feel like a little context might help us to understand why. Over the past few months in the Unitarian Universalist Association, which is the Association of UU Congregations in the United States, we in Canada were part of it until 2002, there's been a controversy that started with a person of color not being hired for a position for which they were qualified. And the reason given was that they weren't a good fit. The question of being a good fit comes up often in conversations about the ways that people in power tend to select people who are like them. And that has implications for the leadership of people of color in our tradition. It has implications for our ministries and our leadership. It has implications for the health of our congregation and our association and our denomination. This justification of not a good fit sparked a wide response, led to numerous people in the UUA leadership resigning, including the president of the UUA, the chief operations officer, and the director of Congregational Life Services, who happens to be my boss's boss. Out of the response came a call from a number of communities, including Black Lives of UU, diverse revolutionary Unitarian Universalist multicultural ministries, who had the good sense to shorten their name to DRUM, Allies for Racial Equity, the Liberal Religious Educators Association, it was Faye who brought this to me first, and the UU Ministers Association, all groups that cross the U.S.-Canadian border. And the call came that said we needed a conversation in our congregations that helped to get a clearer place of understanding about white supremacy. More than two-thirds of Unitarian Universalist congregations in North America, 700 congregations representing hundreds of thousands of people, have held white supremacy teach-ins over the past month. Some are still working towards it. Today, we join them. We are answering a call that was made to us as a UU community by organizations and individuals and groups of people with whom we share a tradition and with whom we share a covenant that calls us to seek right relationship with one another. So, white supremacy. It's an uncomfortable term for me. It's a bit of a painful term for me. It puts a knot in my stomach that aches and a frog in my throat that makes my speech hesitant at best and silent at worst. The first thing that comes to my mind when I hear white supremacy is white supremacists. Raise your hand if the first thing that came to your mind when you heard it is the KKK. Fellows in white sheets and pointy hats, Nazi skinheads with swastikas tattooed on their necks. If that's our starting place, if that picture is where we're going to begin, it's pretty easy to understand where the discomfort comes from. I do not want to be known as that. And yet, those in positions of privilege seeking to avoid discomfort is itself a part of that culture. Not talking about it is not an option. This morning, we're deviating from our normal structure a little bit in service of the teaching. I'd like to show you a brief documentary from the New York Times of white people talking about race, about whiteness. It's about 5 minutes long. I think it helps to surface a lot of the reasons for why we feel uncomfortable. After the video, I'm going to say a few words, followed by an invitation to all of us to reflect privately. And then I'm going to ask you to turn to a neighbor and share with them some of your own reflections. We'll repeat that a couple of times this morning. And at the end, I'll invite you, if you're willing, to complete the little insert in your order of service that asks about questions you have or things that emerged and whether you'd like to continue the conversation. It can be a problematic one. It can be a hard one, and we risk hurting ourselves and hurting others in the process. It can risk bringing up things that are deep within us, things that we've put away or put down. So I'm also offering a follow-up conversation circle on Wednesday at 2 and again at 7. So if you want to come and talk about your reflections, there's a space to do that. That'll be in the farmhouse at 2 and 7 on Wednesday. As you watch the video, try to be attuned as best you can to the emotional and body language of the speakers. There is as much information there as in the words themselves. Peter, can you turn on the podium mic, please?
Apprehensive, because I think there's a lot of reasons why I feel like I should be able to talk about race.
I don't want to say anything that would offend anyone. It's a very touchy subject. It's still difficult, even if you feel like you're on the right side of it, to have a dialogue about it.
Especially for white people, because we don't want to see if the racism that we may be holding on to.
I don't know. Maybe I am racist. I certainly don't like to think that I am. And I think that's too, because the perception, in this society, the perception of a racist is a guy in a robe. Now I understand that it's a system of advantages and disadvantages based on race. So as much as there's the disadvantage piece of it, there's the advantage piece of it, which is what I experience as a white person.
I want to bring up race, and I want to bring it up in a frame that helps my children think that there's no difference. But the mere fact that I might be bringing it up could suggest that there is a difference.
I remember asking a friend of my father's who's black why he was called black, because his skin was brown. And I've learned that lots of people that are white ask this question, and maybe they also received the answer that I got from my parents, which was like, oh my gosh, we're so sorry that she asked that, and it's just a term, like, move on.
One of my third grade students seemed pretty rocked after the Eric Garner case or death, and came up to me and said, you know, why, when you were little, like, were you worried about this stuff too? And I knew what he was talking about before. I mean, I didn't say, what do you mean, what stuff? I didn't want to, you know, play dumb. And I said, you know, no, like, I didn't have to be, and that's not fair. And that was really hard, because he just kind of sat there, and it honestly seemed like the first time that he had considered the fact that not everyone had to think about race all the time.
I know that I'm white, and I guess I'm part of that collection. I don't think about being white. I don't.
I really did not know that I had a racial identity. I knew I was white. I had no idea what that meant, how that had shaped my outlook on life, how that had shaped my sense of optimism, sense of belonging, sense of safety, sense of feeling entitled to go help children that I thought were part of a community that couldn't figure out how to help themselves.
I think that impulse, that kind of colorblindness impulse, comes mostly from white people. Like, I've never heard, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it comes from all people of all kinds, but I've heard it most from white people who are saying, like, let's do this as a way of getting past this racism thing. And I think in part it comes from a sense of shame and guilt about what racism has done, and kind of how racism was built by white people.
I don't want to be ashamed of being, and plus I'm a male. It's like every group out there can be pissed off at me because I'm white and a male. And that's a weird kind of burden that some people do feel, and I certainly feel it sometimes from people that I'm privileged, I get stuff that other people don't get.
I think we're all implicated in a racist system, and I play my part in it as a white person. So I do have individual responsibility and accountability. I mean, I'm part of the system, and I do things that both perpetuate it, and I try to certainly do things that challenge it.
I realize I've never said anything. When I've heard racist jokes, when I've heard racist comments, I've never said anything. I've never spoken up and said, hey, that's racist. Not once.
In my mind, there's no, I'm not involved in any conflict that involves race. I've only been the beneficiary of it. So to talk about it is I don't think I would sound very wise.
Being white means that I have the privilege to think that I'm not affected by racism, or that I don't even have a race, because I have all these other things, like a gender and a sexual orientation, and those are pretty neat, so I don't have a race, but I do, and I'm white.
I invite you to take a moment, reflect on what you saw. Breathe deeply. How did that video feel to you? If you identify as white, did you see yourself in that video somewhere? Did anything speak to your experience? If you identify as a person of color, did you hear things in it that resonated with your experience of the dominant white culture? Take a moment for yourself. Then I'll ring the bowl. And I'll invite you at that point to turn to a neighbor and share your reflections on the video and both the thoughts and feelings it may have raised in you. If you'd prefer not to talk to another person and simply continue a personal reflection, I encourage you to claim that space for yourself, naming it, and for others to reflect with joy your desire to not dialogue in this moment and to find somebody else. This dialogue is not an obligation. You'll have 5 minutes and then I'll call you back in song. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Walking with you, walking with you is my prayer. Walking with you, walking with you is my prayer.
I was hesitant to stop you. Have to tell you. Who found that uncomfortable? Who found reflecting on it uncomfortable? A little bit, some large bits, some woo. I get uncomfortable talking about white supremacy. I get uncomfortable talking about whiteness at all. I'm anxious too about the responses. When we try to talk about white supremacy, I'm anxious that people will say it's not an issue. I'm anxious that people will immediately turn to the Indigenous context in Canada and say, well, that's the parallel, and forget that there are people of color who are non-Indigenous in Canada, who have experienced similar things to what happens in the U.S., who have experienced similar things here. I'm reminded of Mark Morrison Reed, who in his book Darkness in the Doorway talks about the a survey that they'd done about who was perceived to be a legitimate minister and what identities affected that. And that in the initial round of the survey, women, folks of LGBTQ identities, and black folks all ranked fairly low as people who were suitable to be ministers. Over the years, women and LGBTQ folks have made dramatic improvements in that understanding. Yep, people of color have not. We haven't made the improvements in those areas, and there's a piece of this that to me is part of the answer why. I've made answers like those ones that I made to the kids this morning, acting as my human mirror. I said things like that to them. It's not, you know, not me. I'm not like that. But I've been working on that forever. I've been an active anti-racist worker for decades. I worked with No One's Illegal, volunteered with Allies for Equity. My best friend and business partner is queer and black. I'm definitely an ally. Truth is, I'm not. Not all the way. Not all the time. I'm sure that at some point, I've said, I don't even see people's color. I treat everyone exactly the same. Truth is, sometimes I do. Sometimes I forget how people's experience of living in their skin is different than living in mine. Sometimes I fail to see the ways in which the world generally organizes itself in a manner that makes it easy for me to be quite comfortable. The ways in which society is organized for my comfort, for my success, organize that people, so that people who look like me are the norm, and everyone else is something else. As a straight, white, cis, hetero male, I hold pretty well the whole pantheon of norms. I had a partner many years ago in Toronto named Sarah, and she was one of my best teachers. I came home one day and I was so frustrated. It was the end of a long week, a very long trip home on transit with detour after detour, some festival or another, and there were people yakking away on their cell phones, speaking so loudly to the people sitting right across from them. I just wanted it to be quiet so I could read my book. I just wanted them to know, without my having to ask them, that they were behaving incorrectly, that they were making me uncomfortable, that they were taking up more space. Sarah listened to me politely, very gently smiled. Then she whispered that my wasp was showing. It's true. Discretion, privacy, not intruding upon or engaging other strangers, believing that these values are objectively better. All elements of a white supremacy in which my preferences are almost always the de facto norm. And I'm upset when they're not respected. In the work of Tema Okun, he details many of the characteristics that white supremacist culture values. Sorry, I'm going to come back to that in one moment. I want to show you first this slide, which talks about trying to get to a better understanding of white supremacy as an overt, socially unacceptable, the pieces of white supremacy that are socially unacceptable, and the many pieces that we seem to accept just fine. Under unacceptable, you find lynching, swastikas, hate crimes, racist jokes, the N-word. Under the socially acceptable, we find a Eurocentric curriculum, not believing the experiences of people of color, racial profiling, the self-appointed white ally, a celebration of Columbus Day, believing that we are post-racial, tokenism, claiming reverse racism, cultural appropriation, all of these fall within the space that people of color have asked us to be more cognizant of, to be more aware of, is that while we easily disclaim that which is above the line, we struggle with that which is below, like an iceberg. Coming back to Tema Okun, he details many of the characteristics that white supremacist culture values. These include perfectionism, a sense of urgency, defensiveness, quantity over quality, worship of the written word, which the example for which was, if it isn't in a memo, it doesn't count. Paternalism, binary either-or thinking, power hoarding, fear of open conflict, individualism, progress is bigger, more, objectivity, and the right to comfort, the right to not be disturbed. I found this interesting in reflecting on I did a course in Aboriginal theologies, and we had numerous speakers, and one of them came to talk to us about his experience of trying to negotiate dialogue between Indigenous and white folks, and I remember the UUA and CUC actually both issued a refutation of the doctrine of discovery many years ago. And that's effectively a refutation of the notion that that normalized the white settler experience in North America. And people were anxious about our refuting this because they were concerned that it was going to mean we had to give the land back. We had to give the money back. We had to something. It was a pretty generalized anxiety about how we were going to lose our place. And it was interesting in that space because the person who'd come to talk to our group said that this didn't really fit with any of their understanding of how you would have that conversation. Because it presumes that what Indigenous people might be seeking is retribution rather than reconciliation. And that the same is true for African-American communities in the U.S. who seek reconciliation. It's a struggle because we come to these conversations with the values and experiences and cultures that we're part of. For each of these characteristics, Tema Okun offers antidotes. Antidotes we can practice that vary from things that seem quite easy to accomplish to others that require a wholesale reworking of our perspectives. Hard work, both the noticing and the changing. The next question for you to talk about, what experience have you had in the world where your racial identity was either privileged or oppressed by the characteristics valued by white supremacy culture? Where do you see white supremacy operating in this country, this province, or in this city? Breathe deeply. Take a moment for yourself. I'll ring the bowl and invite you at that point to turn to a neighbor and share your reflections on the questions and both the thoughts and feelings it raised. As before, please feel free not to participate or to participate in the pairs dialogue. It's not an obligation. The last thing I wanted to talk about this morning is the way in which our own congregations can sometimes be part of this same system. I heard what I consider to be a pretty unfortunate story recently that concerns a conversation that happened in a Canadian congregation. They were intending to paint a mural, and a proposal was brought forward with some samples of the style of mural and its elements. It was a fairly recognizable Latin American style, and one of the members, seeing the sample, said, "That simply won't work. The people don't look like Unitarians. They have the wrong skin color." I can only wonder how that felt to the people of color that I know were in that room, being told that their skin color wasn't the Unitarian one. We might be tempted to write it off as an individual's off-color remark, one person's bias or prejudice. Maybe that's just that congregation's challenge. I'm tempted to write it off. It would make me feel a lot better, be a lot more comfortable. The sentiment of it, though, lives in all kinds of our practices. Our UU church life, our UU style of worship, the way we UUs do coffee hour, they all serve a culture. And in that way, we privilege some folks over others. I have a friend who is shushed in a UU church for shouting an amen, even though he did it really quietly. I have a friend who had her dish left in the kitchen during a church potluck because someone decided it was too spicy for this crowd. I have friends who haven't gotten jobs in congregations because the identities they hold mean they don't look or act like everyone else. And when I've introduced songs, I've never once said that we'll be singing Spirit of Life by the white songwriter Carolyn McDade, because we presume that our music comes from white folks. We only tend to make mention of it when they don't. To be clear, I'm not trying to say that ours is a bad culture. I'm just hoping that with your help, all of us might get better at seeing the ways in which our practices reflect that culture, the way we live it out in our congregations and our denomination, and how it serves the status quo sometimes and leaves too little space for others. I would live more fully into the beloved community that we are committed by faith to build. The more attention we can hold to seeing our communities and our world as it is, recognizing the ways in which we make or take space, the better off we'll be. The more we can resist the impulse to turn to our own guilt or shame, to our own fragile sides, and instead sit with the discomfort honestly, the better off we'll be. We cannot hold a free and responsible search for truth and meaning when we cannot acknowledge the truth of the water in which we swim. Walking, walking with you, Walking with you is my prayer. Many of you will have a note in your order of service that invites you to reflect on things that you heard today, things you have more questions about, whether you'd like us to carry this conversation forward. Not whether, sorry, how you would like us to carry this conversation forward. I invite you to drop it off at the front here if you have an opportunity to fill it out, or to come join me on Wednesday and come talk about it. Our closing words today are wise ones from the poet Wendell Berry. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to the real work. When we no longer know which way to go, we have begun the real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. It is the impeded stream that sings. Friends, it is a blessing when we know, when we come to know our real work. It is a blessing when we find ourselves upon our real journey. May we flow as that river, the water, and the rocks, singing all the way.